United States v. Torres. Mr. Brindley.
May it please the court. My name is Beau Brindley and I represent surety appellants Noemi Lorenzana and Ignacio Torres Sr. Following a hearing on the government's motion to revoke bond for Ignacio Torres Jr., district court entered judgment against Ignacio Torres Jr., which had been previously withheld, and as a result revoked his bond. After that revocation, the district court did not immediately require him to be taken into custody by the marshals, and Mr. Torres was able to flee this building and ultimately the jurisdiction. The district court subsequently forfeited the home belonging to Ignacio Torres Sr. and Noemi Lorenzana, pursuant to a motion by the government based on a forfeiture agreement. Surety appellants appeal that decision. Forfeiture agreements are indisputably governed by contract principles. And the defendant's flight in this case unquestionably happened after the order was entered revoking the bond. Judge Line, however, explicitly said he's entering judgment, which means he's revoking the bond because once judgment was entered, bond had to be revoked. And once the bond was revoked, there was no further agreement. The contract with the sureties in terms of forfeiture was terminated. And it is a mistake of law to then enforce that contract based on an action that unquestionably took place after the revocation happened.
Of course, you don't have any case law that specifically says that.
No, all I have is basic contract principles as I think reasonable people understand them. I don't understand, and I think there was some examples. We gave some examples in the reply brief. For example, if it was a some particular bank was going to protect this armored car shipment of money until it gets to some place, it gets to the place. After it gets to the place, the bank isn't responsible for what happens next. And Judge Lyon and Weber revoked the man's bond. At that point, the contract is terminated. And I think what the government basically wants this court to do is redraft the forfeiture agreement to make up for an error made by the district court in not having the marshals in the room to take the guy into custody. I think as a practical matter, the problem was that the marshals weren't right in there at the time, and they didn't get him. And then all of a sudden he was gone because nobody expected that to happen that day.
Yeah, and so from and this is just the policy, because certainly word could get out, you know, your bond gets revoked, and if you split, then whoever your surety was is not on the hook for it.
I understand the policy concern that could arise there, but the bottom line is we contract principles for the sureties, the contract principles have to be enforced. And these sureties, once this was revoked and it was over, these sureties didn't have any more responsibility. The answer in terms of policy is not to redraft the contract to fix a mistake the district court made. The answer is whenever you're going to revoke a bond as a district court, have the marshals in there to take the person into custody. Or say, if they're going to let them self-surrender, your bond is going to continue until you do self-surrender, and then it will be revoked. That just didn't happen here. The government, in one of the things the government attempted to do was to suggest that there were other bases for the forfeiture, and they cited a failed drug test was one. That had occurred 5 months prior, there was a failed drug test. Now, the problem with that primarily is this. At the time, the district court didn't find that's a violation at all. In fact, while through counsel, which was me, Mr. Torres acknowledged that a report of positive result had been issued by pretrial services, there was no due process hearing where anyone allowed him to either challenge that report or the methods used or do anything. And the reason there was no such hearing is because no one moved to revoke and no one found the violation. And we can't now say that without a due process hearing on this point, this is the basis for the forfeiture. It cannot be. The same is true with the issue with respect to the contact with the witness. The whole hearing that led to Judge Leinweber entering the judgment and the bond being revoked happened because there was an incident where a cooperating witness said that he had contact with Mr. Torres. There was a disagreement, this is Mr. Torres Jr., of course, there was a disagreement between the parties about the facts of how that happened, whether that was willful, whether that was Torres' fault. And we had asked for a hearing to present witnesses, and that's in the transcript of the proceeding that day before Judge Leinenweber, which you have. And Judge Leinenweber ultimately decides we don't need to do that. There won't be a hearing because what I've done here is I've simply withheld the judgment to allow him to remain on bond. I'm not going to do that anymore. I don't have to. I was giving him a break. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to enter judgment, and entering judgment in this is a narcotics case, that entry of judgment triggered immediate revocation of bond. And that's why the bond was revoked. Judge Leinenweber did not hold a hearing. He didn't make a fact finding and say that was a violation, some contact with the witness. He basically said, I don't even have to bother. I'm going to do it this way. Bond is revoked. So Mr. Torres, again, did not get a due process hearing on the question of whether or not this really happened. The credibility of his witnesses was never determined versus the informant because no witnesses were ever called because no one ever found a violation on that basis.
So let me ask you this. Yes. So what if we have a situation, probation officer goes in, U.S. Attorney's Office goes into the court, says they want to revoke bond, defendant is not there because, mm-hmm. I don't know, he's just not there. His lawyers tried to get him there, he's not there. The court holds a hearing, revokes
yes.
bond.
Yes.
Okay, so at that point you would say the sureties are off the hook as well.
At the point, because the...
When
the bond is revoked, yes. At the point the district court says the bond is revoked. Now, if the defendant had absconded before that, well, the bond was still in place, and that's why he's not in court, they're on the hook. But after the district court says the bond is revoked, then they would be off the hook, and the whatever happens after that wouldn't be their responsibility. And the other issue here that we've raised is the problem of notice in this instance. The sureties are entitled to have notice of court appearances, and the government cites that language from their agreement. The only notice they're going to be given is notice of court appearances. But they didn't get a notice. We had information provided by the pretrial services officer about contacting Ms. Lorenzana, who was the third-party custodian and one of the sureties here, multiple times at different points in this case. But there was no contact made to tell him there's a hearing to revoke. And so there's no indication the sureties even had knowledge that a revocation hearing was happening. If they did and they had known that was going to be, they could have come to court and they could have said, we do not want to serve as sureties anymore under these circumstances. But they didn't get out that opportunity. And the government wants to assume, well, they must have known because Mr. Torres Jr. should have told them. But that's not what it says. It says they would get notice of court appearances and they didn't get it from the court and they didn't get it from the pretrial services office and they didn't get it from Mr. Torres Jr. apparently, but because they weren't there and they had been at other proceedings, but they weren't there that day. And ultimately, after that, when the judge decides he's going to issue a warrant, when it's unclear whether Torres Jr. is really going to come back and turn himself in or not, because it was supposed to be today, is I guess the language that was used, it wasn't clear whether he was in violation or he wasn't. They weren't told at that point that they could come in and have some opportunity to try to find him or do anything. They didn't get notice of that proceeding either. So I don't think they can be held accountable due to a lack of notice, and more importantly, because the only real reason that the forfeiture happens, and Judge Leinenweber was very forthright and upfront about this when we came in on after we disputed this, when he said, well, 99% of the time, if the defendant's in the court, there is no forfeiture. But he's not here, and that's why we're going to have to do this, and that's why the home is forfeited. But that act in this case, and this is a unique case, I think the parade of horribles the government is concerned about is just, it's sort of a tempest in a teapot in the sense that this is a very unusual circumstance where you happen to get a revocation and it's not clear that he's going to be taken into custody and then he's left at large and then he runs away. That's a very unusual set of circumstances, and I think enforcing contract principles and the specific language of the agreement is necessary to protect the right of the sureties who entered that contract believing that's how it would be. And I don't think it's going to do any serious harm in terms of policy, because if we have district courts going to know, they need to have somebody there to take him into custody. With that, I'll reserve whatever is left, Judge.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brindley. Mr. Madden?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Matthew Madden on behalf of the United States. This court should affirm the district court because it was not an abuse of discretion to refuse to set aside that forfeiture order. First, the order of revocation was not immediately operative in this case because the court gave the defendant time to surrender to law enforcement. And until he surrendered, the conditions of bond were still in place. Now, the defense position here is that the word revocation is some magic word which immediately extinguishes the conditions of release, but that is not the case. The defense attorney said to Judge Leinweber, "Judge, when do we need him to surrender?" He used the term surrender for a reason. Defense attorneys and defendants prefer surrender as opposed to immediate custody and arrest, because the immediate custody means handcuffs and you're walking out of the courtroom that way to the side, to the prisoner elevator, straight up to lock up on the 24th floor. Surrender is something entirely different. Surrender is the defense has the opportunity for the defendant to turn himself in to law enforcement on a specified day or at a specified time. Regardless of whether or not marshals were in Judge Leinweber's courtroom that day, the defense attorney would have asked for him to surrender, because surrender allows him that extra time to say goodbye to his family and turn himself in on his own terms later on that day. And the reason surrender is so important in this case is because when a judge allows a defendant to surrender in these types of circumstances, the conditions of bond remain in place. The most analogous circumstance, the defense attorney has given a number of analogies in his brief, but really the most analogous circumstance here is when something happens very regularly in the lower courts in this building. It's when a defendant on bond goes up for sentencing and he is sentenced. The judge, at the end of that, let's say there's a sentence of imprisonment is imposed of, say, 5 years, the judge then gives him a surrender date. The surrender date might be 30 days, it might be 45 days, and what that means is the defendant is obligated to turn himself in to either the MCC or some Bureau of Prisons facility on a certain date. And the key is the conditions of bond remain in place.
And then do the sureties get notice of that?
They would need to get notice of that.
That sentencing.
Yes.
So that they could be there. So if they wanted to back out, they could.
Yes.
He has that time to turn himself in. And so here, the sureties didn't have notice, did they?
There's significant circumstantial evidence that they had notice. And there's no evidence, for example, that his parents were actually there that day, even though there were family members there, but we don't know who they were exactly. But what we have here is, here's the circumstantial evidence that we have. One key here is that Ms. Lorenzana, who's one of the appellants, she had a dual role here. She was not just a surety. She was a surety and she was a third-party custodian. So as a third-party custodian, she had obligations under the bond agreement. She was in court and the Judge Leinweber went over the bond agreement with her and she signed it that day. Her job was to make sure the defendant showed up for the court proceedings, to make sure the defendant complied with the conditions of release, and to advise the court and pretrial services if there were any violations. So what we have there is this surety who's also a third-party custodian, and not only a third-party custodian, she's his mother and they're living together. And then pretrial services officer testified at the hearing and said, gave all these specific dates when he was in contact with Ms. Lorenzana, keeping her apprised of the proceedings, letting her know what's going on, asking if she had any questions, if there were any violations.
But he didn't have any discussion about the bond revocation proceeding that took place.
There was no evidence of that.
And then you cited this Gutierrez case saying that the court was required to forfeit the bond and setting the bond aside while the defendant is at large undermines the purpose of the bond. And Gutierrez also sets forth factors that the district court has to weigh when deciding whether to set aside forfeiture. And there are 6 factors, and I don't think Judge Leinweber made any findings under that. The willfulness of the defendant's breach, the participation of sureties in apprehending the defendant, the cost, inconvenience, and prejudice suffered by the government, any explanation of mitigating factors presented by the surety, whether the surety is a professional bondsman or one of the defendant's friends or family members, and the appropriateness of the bond. There were no findings using that test.
It's true that there were no findings using that test. The defense didn't go through those factors, and we didn't either. But in this case, of course, what we have is the quintessential violation of bond is when the defendant fails to surrender and he flees. And I don't recall the case, but I think there's Seventh Circuit case law that says, of course, that is the heart of why we have bond conditions, is so that the defense appears in, excuse me, so that the defendant appears in court as directed and surrenders to serve a sentence. And so here, when we've got that type of situation, that is probably the most serious bond condition, that if that, when that is violated, it's, as Judge Leinweber said, 99% of the time, that's what you're talking about when you're going to forfeit the bond when someone violates like that. And so on the I'd like to just briefly point out something on the surrender issue, surrender versus custody. Something that Mr. Brindley mentioned and something I noted from his reply brief on page 6. On page 6 of the reply, the defense said, the court allowed the defendant to temporarily be at liberty without the security provided by his bond conditions. And I noted that because that is such an absurd construction and distortion of Judge Leinweber's order and intent that day. So what Judge, just remember that this is the context. The government is in there that day saying that these bond conditions are not enough. The defendant threatened one of our witnesses, and not just any witness, the witness. The exact reason why Torres was in federal court was because of this one person, and he threatened him. And it's true that we didn't have a full-flown hearing, but of course you can proceed by proffer at a hearing, which is what we did, rather than call witnesses. And the defense also made a number of concessions, and it's of course fair for Judge Leinweber to rely on concessions and admissions made by the defense in writing and at the hearing. And at that hearing, the defense admitted that they exchanged words. And that, of course, is a violation when he's not allowed to have any contact with witnesses.
And, yeah, I guess, just in terms of that test, I mean, that test is important, but, you know, it's this issue of notice that troubles me, that the sureties didn't get notice of this hearing, that it was a bond revocation. And they do have that option to pull out. You agree that they could pull out. They could make the request of the court. You know, they know he's coming in, it's a bond revocation, they see the reasons why. If they got notice, they would have that option, right?
They would have that option, Your Honor. But I think what one thing that I think makes no sense about the defense position here is that the reason for notice is, as you said, to give them the ability to object. And what one of the things the defense was talking about that they would have objected to was this Judge Leinweber essentially allowing him to surrender. Because what would have happened, if there were two options, he could have ordered them to go out that way with the marshals, and truthfully then we wouldn't be here, of course, or he allowed him to surrender, and that's why we are here, because that's how he got away. So that's where they would have had to have objected for it to make any difference. They would have had to have said, we object to you allowing our son to surrender. The other option was he should be put in handcuffs and led away. There is no way his parents would have said, we object, Your Honor. We object to you allowing our son to surrender, because that increases the chances that he's going to run away.
But so you're saying that they couldn't say, Your Honor, in light of this finding, we don't want to be sureties anymore.
They could have, yeah, they would have had that opportunity, but what I'm saying is there's no way, as a practical matter, that they ever would have made that objection.
Mr. Madden, in a case where the surrender is put off for 30 or 45 days, as you suggested, and there's no indication, because that time had not expired, that there was going to be a fleeing, during that period, can a surety come in, and the bond has been, quote, forfeit, or ended at the day like we had here?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow the last part of
well,
that.
Well, can a surety come in and request to be released?
Yes, they could. They could do that, and then I think that would give the government the opportunity to say, If the surety is going to be released, the defendant should be taken into custody immediately, because that would be changing the agreement between all the parties. I see that my time has expired. If there aren't any other questions,
So that's why you're taking that position, that it would be rare for the surety to do it, unless the surety no longer had confidence in the defendant. I mean, it could be a situation where they just didn't have confidence in it, and they regrettably, but they didn't want to be on the hook for their house being taken away.
Correct. If, unless there are any other questions, I would just ask that the court affirm the district court in this case. Thank you.
Thanks, man, Mr. President.
The two things I wanted to reply to. The first has to do with a situation where you have a sentencing that Mr. Madden was discussing, and then the defendant's allowed to remain on bond so he can surrender. Here's what doesn't happen at that sentencing. The judge doesn't say your bond is revoked. There's never a revocation. That defendant walks in because he's not in custody, and he's on bond, and at the end they say conditions of bond to stand so he can surrender. So the difference here is revocation, when the judge says the bond is revoked, that is a difference, a total difference. And that's what happened here. That's why that is irrelevant. The other thing with respect to the sureties is they do need to have notice. We can't presume that just because she's his mother that her house is on the line and that she's not going to take a different position when she hears the government's evidence. The government's claiming that he had an argument with this guy that he's not supposed to be talking to. It was a detailed claim about a violent dispute between these people. If she heard that in a revocation hearing, she very well might have said, well, I know he's going to have to go into custody eventually. He's going to have to do some time on this. I just don't want to put the house at risk anymore. She should have that opportunity. She should have that right. And we can't presume that she knew. The pretrial services officer explicitly, we have evidence, did not tell her. No one did. And without that, there's not enough notice to take away their house.
And where is it? Where is it? Is it? It's in that agreement, the forfeiture agreement, that she would get notice. Where is that?
It is in the agreement. It was cited by, I think, both sides.
It was. I just
in the
recall.
Briefing.
Can you
give
me the?
As I stand here right now,
you don't have to look for it.
Where
I just
it
couldn't
is.
Recall.
But it's in the briefing. Both sides have cited that language that you'll get. The only notice you'll get is of court proceedings. And that's a notice that we believe was missing.
Okay.
We ask for you to reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Friendly. Thanks to both government counsel. And the case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the